Going to start using this handheld mic for comments and questions. There are recordings being made for those who are unable to be here. So we want the people who will be getting the recording, some of you may want them just to review, but we want them to have the full benefit of your comments and questions. So there's one mic up here. There's also one in the back. So we'll just ask if, let me just give this, I think, yeah, it'll just need to be turned on whenever we use it. But yeah, if you don't mind taking it, that'd be great. And then, yeah, and then if when we have somebody has a comment or a question, we can do that. Before we press on, are there any comments or questions? Anything that needs to be asked or said before we move on? Okay, we've talked about the gap, living in the gap, and I think that the Christianity is all about living in the gap, and that in the gap. Of course, we feel grief. Jesus himself was called a man of sorrows, acquainted with suffering or acquainted with grief. More than any other human that ever walked on the planet, he was aware of this gap between what ought to be and what is. And so it created tremendous grief for him as he walked on this planet and encountered situations where there was poverty, where there was pain, where there was suffering, where there was prejudice. Everywhere he turned, there was a reminder of the gap between what is and what ought to be. And so this is the life of faith, because the more we understand God's desire for us, the more we experience that gap. And coming into the life of faith doesn't remove us from the gap. Certainly, we are the righteousness of God. When we come into the life with Christ, we are seated with him in heavenly places. We become the righteousness of God. We become partakers of the divine nature. But we are also, as profoundly and powerfully, still miserable sinners. Paul says, that even toward the end of his ministry, I am the chief of sinners. And so we live in the gap and the tension between the ideal and the real. And I like to think of a guitar string or another stringed instrument that has a fixed point and a movable point. If you play the guitar, you know that the strings have to be tuned in order to manage the tension so that music can be played on them. And the tuning doesn't really move the string very much. It moves it a very little, but it's very significant because turning the little knob and managing the tension is what allows music to be played. And really, we are all instruments of God. In the first page of your book, it has a prayer of Saint Francis, Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. And if you want to be an instrument upon which God can play the music of heaven, you've got to get good at managing the gap and living in the tension between the real and the ideal. Not trying to exempt yourself, but trying to manage it according to the grace of God. I just think it's such an awesome picture. Again, even if we do everything in our power, if we get our string all tuned up, we are still dependent on God to play the instrument. He's the one who does the work. It's not us. We just make ourselves yielded instruments to him. Okay, so we talked about the gap. We talked a little bit about the goal. And now we're going to talk about the gift of counseling. Before we move on, any comment about the gap or the goal before we move to the gift? Now, believe me, we're going to recycle through these things throughout the day and deepen and broaden our understanding of these things. But I want to try to do it stepwise so we can lead you into a model or paradigm that I think will really give you something to chew on. The gift of counseling, there's a page in there. It talks about the gift that you need in order to be a gift to others. The gift of counseling is partly a gift that we share and partly a gift that we receive. The prayer that I mentioned of St. Francis says it is in giving that we receive. And so as we give the gifts that God has given us, we are going to find ourselves receiving. But on that page it says qualities for counselor effectiveness. One of the things that we need is a certain amount of psychological health. None of us are paragons of psychological maturity. We all have our junk. But we need a certain amount of health in order to be effective for others. We need a certain amount of spiritual growth. Jesus did not enter into his ministry until he was 33 years old. Moses entered into his ministry when he was 80. Hopefully, most of us are somewhere between 33 and 80. And some of you may be younger, but most of us are in that range between, or I guess Jesus was 30 when he started his ministry. Somewhere between 30 and 80, when most of us enter into the work that God has given us. But the reason that we don't start out so much in our teens or our 20s is that we need a certain measure of maturity and health. We also need a genuine interest in people, and I don't think anybody in the room probably has a lack of genuine interest. I don't think you would have made the effort to be here if you didn't have that. The third thing that's listed there is empathy. Empathy is different than sympathy. It is not, it's not feeling the same as the person you're counseling with. Sometimes you will feel what they're feeling. Sometimes you will feel grief or righteous anger. Sometimes you'll feel a sense of sadness or frustration. But generally, empathy is the capacity to enter into someone's experience well enough that you can validate their emotional experience. You can validate it by sharing through your look, through your posture, and through your words that you understand where they're coming from. If a woman comes to me who is in depression, and she says, "I feel like my life is worthless. I feel like everything I've ever done is a mistake. I feel hopeless. I feel fat and ugly. And if I died tomorrow, no one would care." Okay. Empathy is not me saying, "Oh, I agree with you totally." That's really not what we're talking about. Or it's not even agreeing with part of, "Yeah, you really are a mess." It's really being able to say to that person, "So it sounds like you're feeling really low. You're feeling like your life is meaningless and you're feeling unattractive." And verbalizing back, not her exact words, because that can feel really mechanical and condescending, but sharing the sense of what, the gist of what she's saying in a way that she feels understood, that there's a connection, that you can say, "I can see feeling that way, why you would be feeling so hopeless or despairing." Okay? But it also is important not to, it's important not to just totally agree with the person's view, but it's also important not to jump in and disagree with their view. Because if this woman is saying, "I feel like my life is meaningless, I feel stupid, I feel fat and ugly," if I say, "You know what? Get a life. You're beautiful. You know, you're obviously intelligent, you have a good job, you have 3 kids. What is your problem? There are children dying of AIDS in Africa." I mean, you could do that, but is that going to help? No, it's not going to help her any more than saying, "Yeah, you are fat and ugly." Okay? But me saying, "Hey, you're feeling really bad, and here's what I'm hearing." If she feels that I hear her, then that actually allows her to begin to broaden her view and say, fit in some of the other pieces of the puzzle, to confess other things about her life that may help to round it out. Like, you know, "I know my children would be devastated if I died. I know God has a future for me, but sometimes I just don't see it." So empathy is really important. Personal warmth is a part of that. Being able to generate a sense of that caring. It's not enough just to say, "Be warmed and filled." You know, pat somebody on the head and, you know, like, "Okay, well, hope you feel better." There has to be some real sense through eye contact, through posture, through the words that you use, through the tone of your voice, that there is a warmth that creates an environment where they feel acceptance and holding. Self-awareness is another thing that's very important. I think my year in the wilderness was really important for me to be aware of my own baggage, my own relationship with God, my own history as a person, and my knee-jerk reactions in relationship, so that I can monitor those when I work with people and not just kind of go with the flow of my personality or my preference, but that I can actually be available for the Spirit to use me in ways that go beyond myself. Awareness of values is related to self-awareness. You need to know what anchors you as a person. Your values will inform the way you relate to people. Your values regarding truth, regarding integrity, your values regarding parenting, your values regarding work and rest, your values regarding play and creativity, your values regarding marriage, divorce, your values regarding sexuality. There are so many things. You need to be very clear about what those values are. And when your values conflict with the values of your client, the person you're helping, it's very important to articulate that so that it's explicit that your value there's a conflict of values rather than being unspoken. Because the things that we speak, we can manage. It's the things that we don't speak that can move us in directions that are dangerous. And that's why it's so important for people to see someone who has a Christian worldview, because the values of the counselor will affect the course of the treatment. Whether they're spoken or unspoken, those values will show up. Tolerance of ambiguity. What does this mean? This means that ability to live in the gap, the ability to tolerate the fact that we're both awesome spiritual beings and wretched sinners. The fact that there's a lot of ambiguity in human suffering that we cannot solve. Job's friends did pretty good for about 7 days. They sat in silence, but when they started talking, they started trying to bridge the gap and try to make sense of Job's suffering. They tried to answer the questions that even God did not attempt to answer when he showed up. There are some questions that we must not try to answer for people, because God wants us to live in mystery, in ambiguity, because that's where we find trust. That's where we grow in our capacity to believe that God is good, even in an experience that seems bad. Courage. It is scary sometimes to say what God asks you to say in a counseling situation, or to go into those places of darkness where people have been afraid to go in their lives, to ask the questions that you're not sure you want the answer to ask people how they're managing their life morally, sexually, to invite them to go into those rooms that have been closed off in their soul. It takes a certain amount of courage to say something that you know will be a hot topic or push a button for a person. It takes courage to be willing to go to God in a situation where you feel you have no answers. It takes courage to enter into a session with a sense that God is bigger than we are. Finally, at the bottom, it says faith, hope, and love. I really believe when we do anything, we need to remember 1 Corinthians 13. If I give my body to be burned, if I have all wisdom and I understand all mysteries, if I speak in tongues of men and angels, but I don't have love, it's nothing. So whatever we do, if it is not motivated by love, it's nothing. We also need not only just a sense of love, but we need a sense of faith. Again, we are not, no matter how much love we have, our ability to bridge the gap is still this much. And we need this much. We have to have faith in God's love for people and his willingness to move in situations where he's invited that allow us to believe that God can change people. And what's your name over here in the green shirt? Allison. What Allison was saying was she has faith for other people because she sees what God has done for her. You have to anchor into your own experience of transformation in order to believe that God can do it for someone else. And if he hasn't transformed you yet, you're probably not going to be able to be much use for other people, because you're going to have a hard time believing for their desperate situation in need if you haven't seen God fill your desperate situation in need. So faith, hope is also important. People who come to you will often feel hopeless about their marriage, their children, their life, their relationship with God. And they need some sense of hope. And that's one of the gifts of counseling that is so powerful. If you can look at that person and give them a sense that there is something beyond what they've experienced in the past, that is huge. When Jesus encountered the woman at the well, he gave her a sense of hope. He knew her past. He knew how desperate it had been, how she went from one relationship to another and found nothing. But he said, if you knew who I was, you would ask me for living water and it would well up in you. That you would not need to come to, you know, you'd drink and not thirst again. He gave her a sense of hope, and that was huge. Yes. Let's get you the microphone so they can hear on the tape. And if you would, for the purpose of that tape too, just say your name again. And
yes, thank you, sir. Dan Gray. The courage, I especially appreciate, but sometimes I feel that I have the courage to go into certain portions of a life that, and frequently we'll have one or two sessions of 20, 30 minutes to an hour with a young man, and that's the last he'll walk into the center, and it's awesome when he does, even the first time, because not all young men will do that.
Yeah.
But the courage is often not so much as the ability to flow into something without having a confrontation that seems like you're hitting a guy in the face with a sledgehammer about his lifestyles.
Good, good.
And so I hope we'll
absolutely address that. I think what you're suggesting relates to the idea of respect and awareness that whenever someone shares from their life, it's holy ground. What I found is that it's very important when you're asking about sensitive things to make sure that you let the person know that they can decline talking about this. And especially if you're asking about a personal issue, it's very important to say, I'd like to ask you about this relationship, but I want you to understand that if you don't feel comfortable talking about it, that's fine. But people often assume if you don't ask that you don't want to hear. So I think a lot of times we may be so respectful of people's boundaries that we don't ask the question, but we do want to make sure that we say, hey, I'd like to ask you about this, but feel free to say if you'd rather not talk about it. And sometimes people will say, I really don't want to talk about that, and I'm cool with that. But more often they'll say, no, I'll talk about it. I'll tell you. And they feel honored that you want to hear. Anything else before we move on? Okay. What I'd like to do now is go into the model of counseling that is anchored both in the Beatitudes and in relational development. There's a page in there called Relational Development, and next to it is a page on the Beatitudes. And if you want to have those side by side, you may want to do that just because I'll probably refer back and forth between the two. For the moment, we're going to set aside the model of counseling and look at a model of human development and look at what happens between a parent and a child as they go through certain stages of development. This is a model that, has grown out of years of research in human development. It's a model that you can find in many different texts. The Christian that has done the most in sort of fleshing out a model like this is Henry Cloud, along with John Townsend out in California, wrote a book called Changes That Heal. And his model is very similar to this one, and that something, if you want to flesh out your understanding of relational development, that's a really good one. They're the ones that wrote the book Boundaries, which also has some very powerful information in it that I think you might enjoy. Okay, before we head on, any other comment or question before we get into this relational model? All right. If anybody has a comment or a question as we go along, feel free to flag me down. If you get tired and want to stand up, or if we need a break and I'm going too long, I'll probably try to stop again about every hour. We will eat lunch at 12, so we'll have one more break, and then we'll have another session, and then we'll have lunch. I think you'll see as we go through this, we're going to be, again, cycling through this paradigm or this model to help really get it in your bones so that it will begin to infuse the way you think about where people are in their transformational process and what they need from you as you interact with them. Okay, relational development. What is the first thing that you think of that a child does when he or she enters into the world? When they're born and they come into the world, what's the first act that sort of says, hey, I'm here? Cry. The child cries. And for the first few months of life, that's not very bright. Let's see. Let's try this one. For the first few months of life, the cry is frequent and loud. What does the cry signify? Need. It could be a need for attention or cleansing, a clean diaper. It could be a need for feeding, a need for warmth. I'm going to move this over in the light a little bit more. Is that better? No? Too much reflection? Is that better? No? Was it better where it was? Is that better? Anybody, is that good? Or are you still getting the reflection? What if I do it like that? Y'all can't see it? Any better? Somebody help me. Help! Okay, I'm crying out. Okay, does anybody have a brilliant idea where she put it? Is that okay? What? Back. Is that okay? Keep going back? This way? Is that good? Straight. Are we good? Thank you. I thought I was going to do something good, but there you go. Oh, yeah, get them. Yeah. We'll get it there. I need. A baby's cry is an expression of need. And from the beginning of life, the ability to express need and to reach out for help from others is foundational. It is the primary task of every relationship. It's what we call bonding. In bonding, we form an attachment to others that allows the exchange of good things, whether it be nourishment or affection, affirmation. We need an emotional connection in order for that transfer to be meaningful as people. What we know about individuals, about human beings, is that we are spirit beings. We need to be in connection with other beings that are infused with the Spirit of God. A child who is getting all of his or her needs met physically for warmth, cleansing, nutrition, without the context of a bonded relationship with a caring and consistent individual, that child will not develop properly. They may, take on a condition called failure to thrive, in which they will not develop motor skills as they should. Their brain will not grow as it should. Their body will not mature, and in some cases, death can result. We are relational beings, and a bond with another human being is very important. Even though God is sufficient, in the Garden of Eden, He said, "It is not good for man to be alone." We have a need for relationship. And so if you look at that first beatitude that says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who stay close to their need for others. And a child who is able to cry out is a blessed child. If he has a caring response from his mother, every time the child cries out and the mother responds, a bond is forged. And in our counseling, every time someone comes to you and expresses need and you respond in a loving, accepting way, that forges that bond. So being poor in spirit is what the baby brings to the relationship. Mercy or acceptance or compassion or tenderness is what the mom brings. So the first beatitude and the fifth beatitude form that couplet we were talking about, where relationship born out of need happens anytime there's an expression of need and there's a loving response from that other person. And again, every time over those first few months of life that the child cries out and the mom provides the need, there's a deepening, powerful emotional bond. What happens, though, in a situation where a child cries out and no one comes? A healthy kid is going to do what? Going to cry louder, cry longer, try to do, you know, something to get the attention that he or she needs. But in certain rare situations, fortunately rare, children are in situations of neglect where no one comes. What happens if a child repeatedly cries out and there's no loving response? Does anybody know? They stop. The cry becomes attenuated and eventually stops. And the child's expression of need stops, but interestingly enough, so does the awareness of need. When we were in Colorado, my dad was working with state with a children's home, and in one situation, there were a group of siblings that were being given to the state. The mother had abandoned them, and the father was overwhelmed, and he wasn't, I don't know his circumstance, but he wasn't taking care of them. And so my dad went to this house or apartment to get these kids. And my aunt and uncle ended up adopting them. But the youngest was an infant, and she had been neglected so long that the diaper that was on her body was stuck to her body. But interestingly enough, as neglected as the kids were, she wasn't crying. And the diaper had to be soaked off, and you know. But the child's awareness of hunger, of distress, of discomfort, actually, if there's no one there, they begin to lose awareness of that. And so some of us in this room, if we had an interruption in the bonding process, may have difficulty with expression of need. We have difficulty maybe even being aware of what we need. My mom got spinal meningitis when I was 6 weeks old and had to go in the hospital, and so there was a rupture in the bonding process. And I grew up having a great difficulty being aware of my needs or my feelings. Until I was in college, if you asked me what made me angry, I honestly could not tell you. I wasn't aware of anger at all. And if you asked me what I wanted to eat or, you know, where I wanted to go, I would just say, oh, I don't care, wherever you want to go. I was very much disconnected from my own passion and desire. And so some of the people that you'll meet with have had a rupture in the bonding process. They were in situations where there was neglect or abuse or some other reason. Adoption is another powerful rupture in the bonding process, because the bonding process actually begins during pregnancy. And in a healthy pregnancy, the mother is bonded with that child while it's still in the womb. There's a temporary rupture in that at birth, but then the process of the first few months of life is all about reestablishing and building on that connection. With adoption, even in the best of circumstances, there can be a real challenge in this bonding process and some deep grief that needs to be worked with. Unfortunately, when things happen in these pre-verbal times of life, it's very difficult for people to understand why they feel the way they do about certain things, because they have no memories to anchor in. They don't remember being adopted or being abandoned or neglected. But they just know that there's some reason that they don't feel like they can reach out to other people. Some reason they feel alienated from others. Some reason why they feel different. So bonding is the first thing. And if there's a rupture in it, then the knee-jerk reaction or the defensive reaction is a defensive withdrawal. And some of you, when you feel threat in relationship, that is your knee-jerk reaction. You want to withdraw. You want to protect yourself by backing away from a relationship. People who you will deal with who have a gap in the bonding process are sometimes very difficult to connect with. They don't trust. They don't easily connect. They don't easily express their need, their desire. They're not in touch with their feelings. And it's a really difficult challenge to be able to connect with them. What I'd like to do now is just take a minute and have you share with the people at your table, or with what you can get in your share with the person you were sharing with earlier, or share around the table. If any of you had a know of something in your life where there was a gap in the bonding process, if you know that there was an adoption, or in my case, there was an illness, if your mother had a postpartum depression, her availability to bond emotionally, even if she was able to go through the motions of feeding you and changing your diaper, there's probably a gap there. And so you may also know of someone else who had a gap in this area, but just take a minute to share around your table about where you are with bonding. Is it easy for you to connect with people? Is it easy to express need? Are you very aware of your desires and passions, or do you have trouble really knowing what you want? Part of our process of this training is to help you get to know yourself, to have self-awareness, because the places where you have struggled will be the places where you may struggle in counseling, but it may also be the places where you'll be the most powerfully effective. If you're a person who has gone through a struggle in the bonding phase, then you may be uniquely gifted to be able to reach out to people who also have had that experience. Yes, who has the, where's the microphone? Oh, there's one back there too.
Phil Hayes, how much of that is gender-based versus the bonding you're talking about? You know, how I'm trying to get at, I guess, is men versus women.
Good point. Women tend to be more relational. They tend to get more of their identity and relationship with others. Men tend to be a little more performance-oriented, and we may talk a little bit about how the curse kind of reinforced that man would work by the sweat of his brow but experience futility in his work. A woman would desire for her husband, sort of a symbol of her desire for identity and relationship. I think there is a definite gender difference. Part of what we'll see as we go through the process of development is that a man, even though he bonds with his mother, in order to find his identity as a man, he has to separate in a very powerful way. Men do tend to be more likely to engage in withdrawal defenses than women, but it's certainly not gender specific. There are many women in this group who also will find, when they feel threatened relationship, their knee-jerk response is to get out, to leave, you know, to exit. And so, again, one of the reasons why it's so important to know if this is one of your defenses is that you want to be aware of that so that it doesn't kick in when you're feeling threatened in a relationship with someone you're trying to help. Because if you're not aware of it, then it will unconsciously lead you to, you know, look at your watch, or leave the room, or divert the conversation. You may not physically get up and leave the room, but you will withdraw from a situation where you need to press in. And that's where bonding, the need of the child and the need of the mother, to be able to respond to need by pressing in rather than pulling out, is one of the most powerful things that you need to learn. Can you pass the mic?
Does the bonding process have to be in the beginning of life, or can it occur later in life, like if a mate dies or something like that?
Great question. The bonding process ideally occurs in the beginning, but it must occur with a human presence. And the Bible says that God is a father to the fatherless. And I love that, but I thought, well, why doesn't it say he's a mother to the motherless? I mean, isn't that a more profound deprivation? Isn't that a more profound loss? Why wouldn't God be a mother to the motherless? But I, as I meditate on it, I believe that the reason is that a mother is a skin-on-skin connection. And that just like we talked about John the Baptist, you may be that person that can allow a connection to be established that maybe was not adequately established early in life. That person, you can talk to them all day long about the love of God, but if they don't have Jesus with skin on, they're not going to connect with a God up there unless they connect with a God here. And that's why a ministry like Star of Hope or Pregnancy Assistance Center, you're providing someone that they that has skin on that they can feel is reaching out to them and meeting a need, giving them a blanket or a warm meal like a mother does for a baby. And that experience of Jesus with skin on then can allow them to make that transition from John the Baptist to Jesus or from the caregiver to the great counselor, wonderful counselor. Yes?
My name's Kathy. What if somebody has always had a passive personality, you know, but not aware of any break in the bonding?
We'll go a little on the second Saturday session. We're going to look at people who are really stuck in at these different stages, and we'll go a little deeper into that paradigm of pastoring and parenting. And we'll look specifically at the parable of the lost sheep, the lost coin, the prodigal son, and the older brother, to look at how in the kingdom of heaven we can reach out to someone and bring them in if they're passive or if they're aggressive, hostile, controlling, manipulative, you know, different really deeply embedded things. Sometimes passivity occurs without any clear disruption in bonding, but often when you probe deeply and find out about the character of the mother in the early stage, often you find out that a person who is passive either had a mother who was unavailable or who was overavailable. Ironically, a mother who anticipates the need of her child before the child cries out can create a very passive child because she's always offering the bottle or checking the diaper, and the child doesn't have to feel their need or feel responsibility for getting that need met. And so they can become very passive, and you would think, well, man, they should have a great bond. But if the mother doesn't allow the child to bring their part, if they don't wait until the child cries out, what a psychologist would call optimal frustration, you want your children to experience a certain amount of frustration so that they feel their need for you. You don't rush in before they feel the need. And in counseling, that's one of the things we learn is not to rush in. We may see the need before the client sees the need, but until they see the need, you are rushing in where fools do not want to tread. If we had looked at Moses' experience of trying to bring the Israelites out of Egypt, even though they were very miserable, even they ended up saying, we were better off before. And our situation in Iraq is that we are trying to help some people who really weren't quite aware that they needed our help in the way that we're trying to give it. They knew they were miserable, but they weren't probably ready for democracy, for freedom as we know it. And so we're struggling now. What do we do now that we've entered into a situation where we see a need that they don't, you know, if they saw it as clearly as we saw it, then things would be better. So we don't want to rush in where angels fear to tread or whatever it is. Yes. Oh, yes, ma'am. What's your name?
Deborah Brown.
Deborah?
I have a question. What if a child's like premie or is a medical reason why the mother couldn't bond? Could that possibly cause problems?
Anything like that can cause difficulty. And of course, we live in a fallen world. Jesus says reasons for stumbling will occur, but woe to the one who causes them. I honestly believe that as we look at the lives of those of us in this room, probably all of us have had some gaps in our development as humans. If we had not, we probably wouldn't be here. Why is that? Well, because if you grow up and perfectly negotiate these stages of development that we're going through, then your human identity is going to be pretty stout, secure. You're going to feel pretty competent, pretty satisfied with who you are. And so there are people out there who, if you look at Jacob and Esau, they're like Esau. They're the strong ones. They're the, you know, the productive ones. But their longing for something beyond their human identity is relatively low. Jacob, who was kind of a mess, you know, kind of a mama's boy, felt his longing for God. And God loves those who are poor in spirit. If your human spirit is full, then you're not going to turn to God. If you're humans, if there's poverty in your spirit, if you have a longing and a sense of brokenness, that's when you're going to come to God. God is close to the brokenhearted. That's why the work that you all are doing is so rich, because God's there. He is going to be close to the brokenhearted. When you move close to somebody who's brokenhearted, you get close to God. Isn't that great? I love that. That's where I want to be. But it's not easy to be with people who are broken, especially when it hooks into our own brokenness. And that's why personal healing is so important. Can't stress it enough. Yes, sir. Doesn't sound like it's, is it? There we go.
Okay, here. And I want to go back to what Phil said, because I'm still not quite sure I understand where you want us to think about and comprehend this bonding aspect. The difference between men and women and the gender issue, and what about the bonding of the father? I've heard so many statistics about the fact that if a child's, you know, if both parents go to church and the child's like 70% likely going to continue to go, and if 50% if the father goes, but only like 30% if a mother goes. So I'm thinking about the concept you said about psychological health of the individual. Of course, you were talking about us ourselves, but the individual that's coming in, are we just going to focus on the bonding they had with their mother, regardless of whether they're a woman or a man? Or is the bonding of the father also as important to consider, and where that person is and how we deal with the issues that they're going through?
Well, that's a great question. Certainly, every relationship prepares us for the one to follow. The bond with the mother hopefully becomes a rung on the ladder to allow the child then to connect with the dad. And, you know, as we go through life, we connect with teachers, with pastors, with bosses. We, you know, every relationship sort of paves the way for the next one. But I really believe that in this opening pages of a life, that maternal presence is very important. Can God use a dad if the mom is not available? Yeah, he can. But in his scheme, it's the mother. It's that her giving of herself in a very powerful way. Even in nursing, there's such a profound transfer of my humanity to the humanity of another person. That's such a beautiful image of the bonding process. Can God make up the gap in other ways, through a dad, through a sibling, through a neighbor, or, you know, pastor? Of course. You know, that's the grace of God, is to always be at work in everything to bring about good, so that tragedy ultimately will lead us to triumph as we look to God. But we're talking, if you're going to go into a sort of a superficial counseling setting, you probably don't need to know about a person's early life experience. But if you find out right away that the person was a preemie and was in the hospital for 2 months, or was adopted at birth, at least your level of awareness needs to go up. And if you see someone who expects you to do all the work in the relationship, you need to be thinking about this, because God says, even though he knows what we need before we ask, what does he say? Ask, seek, knock. He doesn't rush in to meet our needs, even though he's aware of them, until we take initiative and reach out. So the reason that we're focusing on this paradigm is to help you not just necessarily go back and dredge up the person's history, but so that you understand some of the underpinnings of bonding and what may be missing in certain scenarios. And by being aware of it, even if you don't say anything to the person, it will help you to hold back and wait for them to ask for certain things. Wait until they are aware of need. You can say, would you like me to, you know, do this for you? But you don't offer to do something until there's that request or awareness of need. We'll talk more about dads as we go through the process of development. Yes? Oh. Why don't you go ahead and get the mic so it'll be on the tape. Go ahead and say your name.
I'm Marlis. And what happens to the mother if the bond is broken through the adoption, the birth of a preemie? the death of a baby, there's a what break in the bonding. How does that affect the mother?
Excellent. Grief occurs anytime there's a rupture in bonding. And the greater the emotional investment, the bigger the gap. The more there's been, if a woman is hugely invested in a pregnancy and she has a miscarriage, the gap can be huge. It can be devastating in terms of that rupture in bonding. And particularly if there's a death or an adoption, there's a finality to it that's very painful. And in going through that process, there has to be what psychologically we call decathecting. It's a process of releasing that energy that we've put into the relationship so that we can move on with life. And it's a difficult process that includes tears and anger and other things. As we talk about grief and depression in one of our sessions, we'll deal with that more fully. Okay? Yes?
It seems like our everyday search is for unfailing love. And I think this is that bonding breakage that we're talking about, mm-hmm. right? That's the baby's need. It's all of our need, right?
Yeah. Right.
So knowing that, does it really matter why? I mean, other than empathizing with them, let them know you understand, the bottom line is they need that. And for them to receive that seems like that would get them, more they receive that, it's the more they're on track. Going in the right direction, get that infilling love through me and other people around them and God. So what does it really matter what happened, whether it was a mental illness or what their dad did, their mother did, or whatever? Does it really?
Well,
when it gets down to it?
It's a good question. Really, the ultimate goal of our life with God is transformation. And how God does it doesn't matter so much. But what we know is that God uses history to demonstrate his faithfulness. And he uses our story to help us encounter his goodness. And from my point of view, the more a person processes their story in the light of the cross, the more powerful it is for them, and the easier it is for them to forgive their own inadequacies and to deal with them when there's some understanding of, oh, that's why I've had such a hard time reaching out to people. That's why I've always felt like I was an alien on the planet. When people have some understanding of the underpinnings, it's so much easier for them not to blame or blame themselves or blame someone else or to feel that they're just a freak. So I think understanding my story really can be very powerful. When I found out that my mom had spinal meningitis, I was like, oh, well, that makes sense. That I understand why bonding was such a difficult deal for me beyond just the surface. So, again, God's goal is for freedom, and he wants us to love him with our whole mind, soul, strength, spirit, every part of us. And so we know that the more we can bring people in an awareness of the grace of God in their lives, the more they're going to love him, and that's really what we want. Yes, sir?
I think it's worth adding at this point that a very large proportion of the young men I see at the Pregnancy Assistance Center who have this longing for relationship with a girl, even a child, and I've seen the young man want the child more than the young lady does. He turns out to be a young man from a totally broken family who does not know his dad or has, in fact, tried to rebond with his dad and not gotten a favorable reception.
Good, good. Thank you. Let's go ahead and let's pause. We'll have a brief prayer. Take just a couple of minutes just to share what this has stirred up for you with the people at your table or the person that you were sharing with earlier. Then we'll take a break, and then we'll have another brief session before we have our lunch. Let's pray. God, we thank you that we are made in your image, that you have given us all a story that is fraught with both frustration and beauty, with awesome possibilities and with also some awful occurrences. And we just pray, Lord, that as we look into this paradigm, this model of development, that we would see you as you have worked in our lives in the past and how you're working in our lives in the future. We know that spiritually you tell us that you want us to move beyond babyhood, to be able to be mature. And so as we look at this model, help us to see where we are in the process of our own spiritual and emotional development, and help us to take the next step with you. In Jesus' name, amen.